It's the 16th of August 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley, and remarkably, we've made it all the way to episode 200. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: are atheists more intelligent than believers, or is someone just misunderstanding all of those A symbols? Did the people behind Straight Pride UK choose to be dicks, or were they just born that way? How will a rational parliament work? And is the tale of a new super-absorbent material a soppy story? But before we begin, the traditional and the untraditional begging slots. First of all, I'm still looking for work. If you'd like to employ me, head over to the Pod Delusion website and follow the links to see my CV. I can do podcasting, digital audio, digital stuff, community management, social media-y stuff. Just go and find out at poddelusion.co.uk. And whilst there, why not subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month? We really do appreciate all of the donations as they help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now we start this week with a new study that claims that atheists are more intelligent than religious people. Rather than critically examine this claim, I'm just going to assume that it's true in blind faith because my parents brought me up to believe in meta-analyses. Our first contributor, on the other hand, Tessa Kendall, is one of those annoying sceptics and has been looking to see if the evidence for it stacks up. Ugh, why does she have to be so militant? Here's Tessa.
A new meta-analysis has found that intelligent people are less likely to be religious, if you believe the media coverage. What often happens when research is published is that journalists read the press release, or at best, the abstract, which is the summary, of the research paper. This is partly because of tight deadlines, and partly because many journals charge for access to the full paper, $25 in this case. Then people who have a particular axe to grind jump on the results and get either outraged or smug, depending on the findings. A meta-analysis is a study of studies. It looks at all the research done on a particular subject to collate and analyse the results. In this case, it covers studies done between 1928 and 2012. The abstract begins. A meta-analysis of 63 studies showed a significant negative association between intelligence and religiosity. However, the abstract is not the whole story. The discussion at the end of a paper is where the caveats are found and gives the full picture. The paper is long and complex, and these are just some of the caveats that need to be taken into consideration before any intelligent atheists start patting themselves on the back. The percentage of males taking part in any survey or study had a significant effect on the findings. The more men there were, the stronger the finding that intelligence makes people less religious, but the less representative it is of the population as a whole. Education levels were not found to correlate with belief levels, although college students were more likely to be or to become non-believers. No studies from outside the English-speaking world were included in the meta-analysis. The authors conclude that, clearly, the present results are limited to Western societies, and that any negative correlation between intelligence and religiosity may also be limited to the American Protestant population. Without comprehensive and culture-appropriate studies of countries where the main religion is Hinduism, Judaism, Islam, and so on, no definite global conclusion can be drawn. In some of these countries, cultural factors may affect the results. It may be socially difficult to be a non-believer in some parts of the West, particularly if you want to be a head of state, but it's not life-threatening. In some countries, the intelligent position may well be to at least profess belief, even in a survey. The researchers also acknowledge that measures of intelligence used in the West are not appropriate for all other cultures, particularly in the Third World. There's another reason to be cautious in evaluating any findings. While the ability to increase IQ test scores can be learnt, intelligence is an innate characteristic, but not a value-neutral one. There is almost always a value judgment implicit or sometimes explicit when intelligence levels are identified. As with height in many cultures, more intelligent often means superior, better, more worthy. Some of the papers analysed had flawed methodology when it came to measures of global intelligence. For example, one included a graph which appeared to show that the average IQ in some countries is under 65. There are also some outliers that appear to indicate fewer atheists in so-called more intelligent countries. The meta-analysis also proposes various reasons why more intelligent people are less religious, but admits that these are speculative and may well not apply in, for example, Scandinavian countries where there are higher percentages of non-believers. Some of the reasons it proposes are that intelligent people are non-conformist, better able to resist cognitive bias, and are more analytical. However, a poll in The Guardian currently shows that 74% of people agree with the finding, but unless they've read all the research, this reaction is more likely to be based on wishful thinking and self-affirmation than on reason and analysis. The result may also show that Guardian readers are highly conformist with each other. I'm not an apologist for religion, I'm an atheist and a secularist. It's really important that those of us who claim to stand for reason don't fall into lazy thinking. That we don't let the media lead us by the nose into knee-jerk reactions that make us look as eager to believe anything that confirms our personal biases as any religious fundamentalist. It's also important to remember that correlations don't apply to everyone. There will always be outliers, highly intelligent people who do believe, and less intelligent ones who don't. A correlation is not one size fits all, and it is not necessarily an indicator of causation. Even if there turns out to be a global correlation between intelligence and belief, what then? There's the obvious point and laugh satisfaction for certain atheists, but what do the rest of us do with this information? If belief is tied to intelligence, then it could be harder to overcome or modify its negative effects on societies and individuals to ensure equal rights than if it were closely linked to culture or education. The idea of religion as a virus that can be cured through debate or education fails. And, significantly, the people, the men, in charge of religions are not stupid. The last line of the paper is, obviously these conclusions are a topic for future research. In other words, don't put out the bunting just yet. The main problem here is that it looks like there's a correlation between intelligence and religious belief among American Christians, but we're not sure about the rest of the world. Doesn't make a very good headline. This is Tessa Kendall reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, one of this week's big Twitter shitstorms was whipped up by a group called Straight Pride UK, which I guess is a sort of reaction to the gay rights movement. I know what you're thinking, I can't believe it turns out that the group calling themselves Straight Pride UK are a bunch of dicks. But sometimes I wonder if they almost have a point. I mean, we hear a lot about homophobic abuse, but what about homophonic abuse? I hear it all the time. At least, I think I do, but then I usually realise it means something completely different. Anyway, here's Rich Firth Godby here, doing some straight talking.
I'm sure many of the listeners to The Pod Delusion will know all about Straight Pride UK. This is a group of people who, in almost no time at all, have created and shelved a website, annoyed almost everybody with a voice on the internet, falsely used a digital millennium copyright takedown notice against a blogger, created and then removed and then created again a Twitter account of sorts, and managed to be roundly mocked by everyone from the New Statesman to the Pink News to, well, us now. They have even managed to inspire a quite funny parody website, straightprideuk.co.uk, who declare that a, quote, celebration of one's sexuality, quote, is, quote, not a bigoted or intolerant thing to proclaim. We just use this fact to spread vinely failed homophobia, end quote. Perhaps too close to comfort to the original site. That original site, straightprideuk.com, proclaims, or rather proclaim that, quote, modern society has come to look down upon the heterosexual mainstream as being unwilling to accept the homosexuals who have chosen to be different. In doing so, the pink mafia has itself become unwilling to accept those who make up the straight majority. There is nothing right with being homosexual, there is nothing right with being bisexual, and there is nothing wrong with being heterosexual and being proud of the natural orientation. End quote. Natural orientation, chose, some interesting buzzwords there, but let me continue. Quote, if gay people have pride, why shouldn't straight people have it too? We intend to make this reality. They have goals. Yeah, they certainly do have goals. Their goals are, according to the website, quote, to raise awareness of the heterosexual part of society and ensure that their presence is known and that their views are heard. Okay. In the current politically correct society, or actually they put political correct society, but I can speak in English, the government focuses too much on the homosexual minority. this is not equal. We must raise awareness of heterosexuality and traditional orientation. And they state that heterosexuals do not have equality. Homosexuals have more rights than any sector of society. Yes, I'll let that sink in a little while, and I think I'll read on. Okay. The fact of heterosexual second-class status within Western society is demonstrated by a number of well-known but ignored facts. This is a short sample for illustrative purposes only. The present dogma of homosexual victimhood within queer ideology affords political power to homosexuals embracing it, but ultimately locks homosexuals into the role of children lacking adult agency. Oh, hang on. I'm reading the wrong thing. And these lines are from a men's rights activist website, A Voice for Men. I think I just accidentally swapped women for homosexuals and feminists for queer there. Sorry, that was that last paragraph. Let me go on. Let me try something else. All of organised society trumpets a tremendous growth of a once unheard of phenomenon, the appalling surge in the number of homosexual couples and their adopted offspring. Movies, television, magazines, newspapers, ministers and popular music all promote this non-mixing of the genders. What is behind this great wave of homosexuality? Are there ulterior motives behind this massive campaign to boost this previously forbidden activity? Is it something that responsible citizens should promote or oppose? Oh, hang on, I've done it again. This is from a piece by the Ku Klux Klan's own Ed Field on the website Stormfront, echoing similar racist statements from 50 years earlier about interracial marriages. I think I just mixed up some words again. Let's try again. Many of the laws imposed on Britain by the EU, particularly those concerned with enforcing equality, have directly affected the ability of heterosexuals in Britain to practice their sexuality in public. Homosexuality urges the British people to accept the values and worldviews of all persuasions as being equally legitimate. The one notable exception to this is the culture of heterosexuality. I know, you may have guessed, that's a Christian voice trying to make a claim for Christian persecution in the UK. I just swapped some of the words again. Shall I try one more? Yes, I think I will. This is the first demand we must raise, and that heterosexuals are set free. These chains be burst asunder, that heterosexuals be once again captains of their soul and masters of their destinies, together with all those who want to be a heterosexual. And the fulfilment of this first demand will open up the way for all the other reforms. And here is one thing that perhaps distinguishes us from others as far as our programme is concerned, although it is very much in the spirit of things, our attitude towards the homosexual problem. Wait, yes. That was Adolf Hitler talking about Jews in a speech delivered by him in Salzburg in August 1920, with a few words changed. Now, before anyone accuses me of falling foul of Godwin's law, I'm not accusing Straight Pride UK of being Nazis. My point is, it is common throughout history for those in positions of privilege to lash out at anyone attempting to level the playing field. More often, it's male, white, heterosexual Christians who are guilty of this, mistaking the loss of privilege for some kind of attack on their way of life. Some of the things cited by Straight Pride UK are quite stupid. One example, they say straight people can't enter a civil partnership, but gay people can. This misses the point. Civil partnerships only exist because what I might call the heteriarchy was too short-sighted and too bigoted just to allow homosexuals to marry in the first place. Like men's rights claims that men are being persecuted because they die 5 years younger than women on average, which is true and is generally biological. A Voice for Men also add incredible pearls of idiocy to their site, like, quote, to date, no published writing, online or in print, has made any serious refutation of men's rights arguments, end quote. That is, if you don't read anything online or in print discussing men's rights arguments. Equally, Christian Voice's use of what they think are irrefutable quotes by such well-known hard-of thinkers such as Peter Hutchins and Bishop Tom Wright have a similar effect. And it won't be long before claims of we win, we win echo from the pages of Straight Pride UK. Indeed, in some cases they already are. Like the last gasp of a dying beast, they will digitally scream and shout. But, as Shakespeare said, it is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. History has taught us that when those with too much privilege begin their desperate pushback, it means that their privilege is finally slipping. Don't see straightprideuk.com as a bad thing. See it as a good thing, because it means, like with secularism, racial equality, sexual equality, and so on, those of us on the right side of history are winning the argument. If we are to take Hitler as our example of the alternative, it doesn't bear thinking about. This is Richard First Godby here for the Pod Delusion.
Now, we're only a month away from the next big project that's being funded by Simon Singh's Good Thinking Society. September the 10th sees the first sitting of the Rational Parliament, which creator Adam Smith hopes will provide a more rational alternative to the House of Commons. To find out more, we caught up for a brief chat in the Parliament's home, Conway Hall in London. I started by asking him, what's wrong with the Parliament we already have?
Well, it's not very rational in many ways. No, I think a lot of people get really annoyed by politicians making this noise, "Wee!" quite a lot, which, you know, might sound like what's more appropriate in a pub on a Saturday night or something. But so I think that noise, the jeering and the politicians ganging up on each other is a symptom of groupthink. And that's obviously a result of the party political system that we have. And that doesn't necessarily lead to critical and free thinking. And I think that's what I would really want people to be doing when they're thinking about big political decisions and big policy questions, is, are they thinking critically, or are they taking a dogmatic opinion because that's what their political party agrees with, or it's because of what their profession tends to go along with or something like that.
So how does your idea actually work? You're holding meetings and you're basically holding a parliament.
That's right. We're going to simulate a parliamentary debate. It's a kind of parallel parliament in a way. So we are going to be picking very current topics and having a debate with a bunch of people, around about 100 people, who are hopefully from all different sectors of society and certainly representing different opinions and different views on the particular topic that we choose. Special thing about the Rational Parliament is that there's going to be relevant researchers in the room. And this is really quite an important part of being a rational parliament, I think, is that you would have people who are studying this particular topic from lots of different angles, but that their research is publicly funded. That's really the kicker here, is that they work for a university or a research institute, and they conduct their research primarily for the public good. And so to have those people in the room, but not given any extra special expert status, arguing alongside everyone else, including the business interests, including the faith interests, if there are any, including activists and campaigners, as well as just interested members of the public who like to have a decent argument, is really the unique selling point. And so that's the idea. We're going to have 100 people, including those people that I mentioned, in a room. We'll have a title motion and a policy board onto which every single member of the Rational Parliament, that's anyone who turns up, can post their feelings or their views about the topic, and also can propose motions. And we will debate those motions and pass or reject them.
And what I thought was interesting on reading the website was that you're going to put together, I guess, like a paper to show to the politicians and say, this is what the rationalists think.
That's right. That's certainly one of the main outputs that we'll produce. And that will be probably a synthesis of all the different arguments and different views and things that we had posted on the night, whether or not we got time to debate them all. It means that we can also reproduce them in that document if we didn't get time. Hopefully we can social media it up and everyone will tweet it. So examples of topics that we might do would be GM food. Should we do it or not? Is it rational to do it? There's a lot of evidence, some people say, that GM food is perfectly safe. But is it rational to do it in the UK? Is it rational to produce it and sell it when a lot of people feel queasy about it? That's, I suppose, our form of rationalism, is not just let's look at the evidence, but let's look at everything. Other topics would include fracking. Should we do that or not? Is there enough evidence to say that that's the kind of energy that we should be building our future on? Is there enough evidence to say that it's not safe? Political parties. Is it rational to have a political party system. A state religion, do we need a state religion? Is it rational to have a state religion when you have a state which comprises of people of all sorts of different religions? So there's lots of different ways of taking this.
When we defer to academic experts, I can see how this would work in the context of, say, fracking or something like that. But are a lot of these topics not underwritten by, essentially, values which can't refer to evidence? I mean, on GM, for instance, my personal position on GM is the science is probably fine and all that, and we shouldn't smash up research. But then the arguments about the corporatization of the food chain, I think, have genuine weight. But again, that's not something I can point to scientifically per se. That's a value. That's maybe a right on anti-capitalist.
That's a really good example of the balance between scientific evidence and personal values and ethics, and that is exactly where the rational parliament sits. The point is, we need to try and make that balance better than we are doing at the moment. So instead of having people who say only the science is fine, let's do it, and people who say, I really don't like the idea of corporate control of the food chain, so therefore I'm going to smash up the science. The point is, both of those positions are untenable ultimately, because we've all got to live together and be friends. So the rational parliament is trying to bring both of those people together, and not necessarily try and get them to agree, because they'll all have different views, but to actually, I suppose, at least make them talk, and moreover, to talk to people and answer questions from people whose views are not so entrenched on either side.
So that's GM, which has an anchor in science. But what about, say, something like, would you tackle the economy, for instance, because you've got, the two major schools of thought, the right and left or whatever. Can you refer to science? I mean, I me speculating aloud now, I would say the problem with economics is there's so many indicators and tools and stuff, you can draw whatever conclusions you want. How can we approach something like that rationally?
I've maybe been a little bit unfair by talking about science when I really mean research. It's often easier to talk about science because you can anchor it in a topic like GM or fracking or something. But the point is that there are thousands of economists researching this subject. And as you said, you can slice economics in any which way that you want to get the ideological position that you think that the country should take. And that's, that's fine. But let's have that debate. I think this financial crisis that we're in has demystified the role of economists, by which I mean we all know that they are not these amazingly intelligent people who sit in ivory towers and decide how the economy should be run. We know that they're human beings with political views, and that their research, may or may not reflect that. The point about this is that because this financial crisis is affecting everyone kind of feels like they really want to know what's going on. And if you ask most people, including myself, most people say, I don't really know what's going on in this economic environment. So you could absolutely have a rational parliament debate on what's the best economic model. Like, what does the evidence say? Whichever position you argue, if you're an economist, then tell us a little bit more about your ideological leaning as well at the same time, so that we have that context. But let's have that. Let's have that debate. Let's look at examples from history. We'll have some historians in that debate maybe as well, and some philosophers. The moral philosophy argument about economics and the best system. So I think that when you think more broadly about research and the amazing wealth of research and that we have in the UK and the diversity of it, it's phenomenal. And you can take this any way that you want. And the point is, we're not going to come out with a full-on policy position that we think this is what the rational parliament thinks the government should do necessarily. We're just going to say, this is the debate that we had on this particular day, and this is the way that we thought it should go. And here are all the different viewpoints.
And if you'll allow me to play devil's advocate one more time, you mentioned the importance of the research being publicly funded for getting the people you advocate. But could an argument not be made that by being publicly funded, that almost is taking an ideological position in itself? I'm thinking of Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's former chief of staff. In his book, he argues that fighting the civil service and the sort of entrenched interests there is almost harder than fighting the Tories.
I think that the reason why I talked about publicly funded research was simply as one of the most convenient levelers, really, in order to start the debate. So everyone else is welcome. Everyone else, members of the public, are welcome. But every researcher who has got funding from whatever source are welcome. The publicly funded research is just a very, very simple rule where we're saying that the beginning of each debate will be opened by two or three researchers just to set a few terms for the debate and just to enlighten us a little bit about what their work is. Again, they don't have any extra status in their debate. They are just there just to introduce us to the topic. And it's those people whose research must be publicly funded. And that's just an attempt at neutrality, which doesn't really exist anyway, as you've said. And I agree with you on that. It doesn't exist. But it's almost the best that we've got in order just to start the debate. And then bring on the people who work for companies doing research, or the people who receive funding from wealthy private individuals or something. Anyone else is welcome. And of course, most people are going to be members of the public who are just interested in this topic anyway. It's really just to start the debate. It's just a starting point.
Excellent. And so I guess finally, so when is the first debate? It's about GM, that's why we've been talking about it. But when is it, where is it, and how could people listening get involved?
Great. I really want people to come and get involved. I'm really excited about this. I'm really nervous about it. It's the first debate that we've done with this format, so the whole thing is going to be an experiment in itself. And there might be some researchers who come along who want to research how this debate is done and how we talk about GM and public dialogue. It's an old topic now. The first sitting of the Rational Parliament will be on the 10th of September at 7 p.m. in Conway Hall in central London. The topic, as you said, will be GM. The title motion is, "This House agrees that genetically modified food is a rational approach to meeting food demand." So we will either pass or reject that motion on the night. It might get refined as a result of a number of other motions that we pass or reject on the night as well. And people can get involved by looking on the website, which is rationalparliament.org. They can sign up to our newsletter. They can sign up to come to the event, the first sitting, which is entirely free. And I'm especially interested to hear any ideas that people might have about the format and about the topic. And if anyone is a researcher, especially a GM scientist who wants to come along and talk about their work in a political context, if they're not fed up of having done that for the past 15 years, then they're really welcome as well as anyone else. So it's rationalparliament.org.
Excellent, and we'll put links to all of that on the Pod Delusion website. Do you get to be speaker and say, like, order, and all of that?
No, I don't. I'm just going to be a shadow lurking in the background, watching how things are going. We have an excellent Speaker of the House who's our moderator. He's Michael Brooks, and he was an editor at New Scientist and now writes for the New Statesman. And Pod Delusion listeners might remember that he ran for Parliament against David Tredinnick in Bosworth in 2010 with the Science Party in order to shed some light on the fact that David Tredinnick was talking quite a lot about homeopathy and about surgeons and moon phases and things like that. So Michael is no stranger to science and politics and research, and so he's our Speaker of the House. He'll be doing the order. I should say as well that we have some really quite fun, gimmicky turns to the debate. Members of the Rational Parliament, when they arrive, will be furnished with a little two-sided sign. One side says, "Evidence, please," so they can hold that up if someone is saying, "Well, I heard that 9 out of 10 hamsters don't like GM food." They have to, if enough people hold up their "Evidence, please" sign, then those people will have to provide evidence for that. They can do a quick search online or something. And the other side of the sign says "Grey Matters," which members of the Rational Parliament can hold up when they think that someone is being too black and white about an issue, whether they're being too scientistic and saying the evidence says this, so therefore we should do it, or whether they're just being too dogmatic in some other way. And then we will have a ballot box as well with a vote for the final motion.
It's sad. I'm hoping to go along myself.
Please do, come along.
Azam, thank you very much. That was fascinating.
Thanks.
Now, the sad case of Neon Roberts has been in the news this week, following his mum losing a legal battle to be able to stop her son receiving treatment for his brain tumour. As sceptical types, it can be very easy to point the finger and attack people advocating such bizarre ideas, but in this next piece, Keir Little thinks that we should be more careful.
Neon Roberts was a 7-year-old boy at the heart of a high court battle between his parents to determine whether he should seek medical treatment for his brain tumour or alternative and complementary therapies. His mother believed that the treatment would be harmful, that it would break him, that it would cause irreparable harm to her child. His father insisted that it was the only way to save him. The High Court sided with the father and the doctor, and Neon received 30 sessions of radiotherapy following the removal of a large brain tumour last year. He made good progress, and the doctors were cautiously optimistic that he would make a full recovery. And indeed it came to pass, and Neon is still with us today. Neon's mother has since claimed that the radiotherapy has made Neon grey and fragile, and that he is not the boy she knows anymore. She says that she looks into her little boy's eyes, and there is nothing there. It's hard not to become impassioned or emotional about the case of Neon Roberts. It's hard not to look upon this as a microcosm of every issue skeptics have with alternative medicine, the nightmare scenario where people want to choose pseudoscience over treatment. And it's hard not to direct some of that irony, some of that emotion at Neon Roberts' mother, to turn her into some sort of villain. But as skeptics and as human beings, it is also important to remember that she has been misled. She has been sold promises of miraculous cures, that ineffective treatments are effective, and she has been convinced of this by those who make their money from such treatments, and by those who also put their own stock in them, and their own belief. It's part of a wider problem. A wider problem whereby we treat health as a personal choice, not as a matter of evidence, not as a matter of a randomised controlled trial to see what works, or a meta-analysis to compare different treatments. We think we make informed consent about these decisions. People think they are informed when they choose to take homeopathy, or choose to see a chiropractor, or choose to go to the Brzezinski Clinic. But the fact is, they're not informed. There isn't the evidence to support their choices. There isn't the evidence to say the treatment they have chosen works. In effect, they are choosing false hope. They are choosing ideology over evidence. They are choosing to risk their children's lives or their own lives, but it's not their fault. We don't have an inbuilt science gland, something that tingles when we encounter news of a new treatment or something that we're told can make us better. We don't have an RCT sensor within our brain that detects whether or not something is real medicine or whether it's bullshit. Our brains are convinced by all manner of things, and it's not always evidence. Numbers are a poor substitute for a good story well told. So while I am appalled that Neon Roberts, at age 7, with a life-threatening tumour, was taken on the run by his mother, and his family had to go through a lengthy court battle so he could get life-saving treatment, I can't find it in myself to just blame the mother. The blame lies with those who reject evidence, with those who would put their own ideologies above a child's life, who would put their own faith or their own bank balance above the welfare of a child. Those are the people that make me angry, not the frightened mother of a child who genuinely believes a medical treatment will harm her child. It is the sad truth that many forms of alternative medicine turns loving parents into child abusers. And we can feel free to play the blame game if we want, but in reality, no one directly involved in this case deserves that blame. The charlatans, the quacks, deserve their fair share of the blame. But we should all take on board the failure to make people realise that evidence matters, that to have informed consent You must have evidence. You must have proof of efficacy. Health is an individual matter, and it is a personal choice. But it is a personal choice that must be informed by evidence, by science. It is not something that should be informed by anecdotes, false hope, and the smiling faith of a well-meaning quack or a crooked charlatan with his hands in your pocket.
Now this week, scientists accidentally created a brand new material known as Upsalite. Apparently, it's the world's most efficient water absorber. So suck it, Bounty. To tell us more, here's Dean Burnett.
We all tend to make mistakes at work, and by and large, it's never really a good thing. I mean, you can do all sorts of things. You can spill boiling hot coffee in your lap, which is always quite painful. You can do exactly that just before a big important meeting where you're giving the main presentation, in which case it's even more inconvenient. It's also painful and embarrassing and probably quite dangerous to your future prospects. Some of you have heard people of doing things like writing an offensive email about their boss for a joke and sending it to their boss, accidentally putting their name in the address bar rather than the subject line. These are the sort of things which people can do by accident in the workplace, which lead to, at best, embarrassment, at worst, terrible career prospects from then on. However, it's not always the case. It doesn't always have to happen that way. For example, you could work at Uppsala University in Sweden, where, well, I say recently, perhaps in the last year or so, some researchers in a laboratory dedicated to materials research accidentally left their equipment running all weekend. In most labs, this would be a terrible thing. If you leave the Large Hadron Collider running for most of a weekend, you probably will cause some serious damage to at least the research, if not the fabric of the universe. However, not always the case. This chemical research we're talking about here, strange things can happen. Well, long story short, they end up creating a sort of gel-like substance, which when dried, created a substance that's now known as Upsalite, named after the university itself, because it was technically discovered, inverted commas, there. What it is magnesium carbonate, a sort of common type salt. Well, the carbonate groups are relatively common, we see them a lot around. But it also has very unique properties in that it is possibly the most absorbent material known to mankind. So much so that until this point it was believed to be impossible, dubbed the impossible material. The methods used for creating similar substances from the similar periodic group actually do work, but it was not believed they would work for to make magnesium carbonate. The other carbonates have similar properties, but nowhere near as extreme. And German researchers in 1908, this is how far back they were being researched, said that it is not possible to make magnesium carbonate in its dry form, which is obviously important. It needs to be dry if you're going to use it to absorb water at all. So why is this really, anyway, particularly impressive? I said it's only quite impressive because it's meant to be impossible. They had the gel-like substance and then dried it, and they suddenly composed into this rather innocuous-looking powder, which it turns out has these remarkable properties. It has these remarkable properties because of the way it's structured. Magnesium carbonate, under a microscope, looks incredibly, let's call it rough, like rough terrain. It's way beyond that. It's so pitted and scored and lumpy and really quite convoluted. The actual roughness of it and the sort of the general physical structure is so much so that it has the highest surface area per gram of any known sort of substance. A single gram of Upsalite, if stretched out so it achieved a flat surface, would cover 800 square meters. That's a gram of 800 square meters. Imagine taking a tennis court and crumpling it up, if you could take a tennis court, the actual area, not the sod and the turf, that would take a bit more space, I suppose. But if you could crumple up a tennis court so much, so tightly, so, you know, so small, you actually need a tweezers to pick it up. And that's the sort of dimensions we're talking about here. Upsalite is that level of condensed surface area. Of course, this doesn't look like anything to someone on a macroscopic scale, like a typical human, but at the molecular level, or the chemical level, this obviously does have strange and rather impressive properties. That's a lot of space for molecules to adhere to. Another reason why it has such extreme surface area is because the structure is essentially riddled with these little pores, which are just under 10 nanometers across. That's like a million times as narrow as a human hair. And human hair is fairly narrow to begin with. But that's like, we're talking extremely tiny here. So much so that water molecules can get in there and get quite trapped, and the surface of this substance is riddled with these pores and these pits and sort of recesses. which can just suck up water. And it does this at relatively low humidities. So it doesn't have to be like a sopping wet atmosphere for it to work at all. It can be a regular room temperature atmosphere. And it does, even when it's relatively dry outside, it'll still suck up the humidity in the air or the environment around it, more so than any other known substance. And this, of course, leads to numerous commercial applications. Because water, we like water. Water is good. Let's not get any mistake about that made. Water is essential for life, essential for all the sort of processes. It's a chemical buffer which lets just things happen. It's the properties of water alone are extremely important. Like it's liquid at room temperature, which all other chemicals in that group, again, similar periodic group, aren't actually the case. The unique properties of water and its polar bonding make it actually, you know, integral to life on Earth. But there are times when its presence can be slightly irksome and disruptive and just plain annoying, and it can stop things happening. Like the manufacture of very fine electronics. Normally, of course, you keep water away from electronics. That's just a health and safety rule. But even when you're forming them, water in the atmosphere can be actually quite disruptive. Like we're talking about some things that occur at high energy at very, very small scale. So a single, like, tiny amount of water in the air can still interfere with like the chemical bonding when things are really high temperatures or when things are really sort of sensitive chemically. Water can actually disrupt things. Water does have a pH level, let's not forget that. It's pH 7, but you know that's in the middle of the scale. But in some times you need different things. So how do you get rid of like water in situations like this when you have such fine chemical changes are needed or such fine instruments or such fine processes are occurring? You obviously can't just like have a fan on them. That's not going to work at all, or just turn up the heat, because that's something else which can be quite disruptive. So that's where molecules like this come in. Epsilite is going to potentially make things like this a lot easier. Just like a scattering of epsilite around the place could really reduce the level of water in the surrounding environment. This process actually works now. It's a sort of a heating and soaking alcohol type process. It's not exactly cutting edge. Well, it's cutting edge science, but it's not exactly like fundamental Large Hadron Collider levels of energy we need here. It's economically viable. It's not exactly a huge, you know, energy demanding process. So if you can produce large quantities of epsilite in at commercially affordable levels, then they can be used in lots of different things, such as even large scale things like warehouses where like food contamination with water, when water gets into food, it goes moldy quite quickly, but if you're storing it long term, that is something which occurs. Water in buildings generally can build up and cause damage. So like this sort of thing can be used to just suck the water out in the atmosphere, or even stuff like chemical spills or toxic waste where the presence of water is a pain, a really sort of difficult thing to do, or a difficult thing to get around. This molecule or this compound actually does lead to many potential possibilities whereby these things wouldn't be such a big deal anymore. It could actually be a lot more affordable and cheap and easy to clean them up or stop them happening or whatever you want to call it. It depends on the context, obviously. Well, what they've invented here is basically, by accident, the world's most powerful mop. You see, you put epsilite in water, the water is suddenly gone. The epsilite is just still sit there being quite inert. It's like those, you know, the silica gel packets you get in like clothes, and it just says do not eat on them. It's sort of a bit like those, or like if one of those was bombarded by the same accident which created the Incredible Hulk. That level of absorbency and potency. But it's also quite nice to think that this is all came about due to an accident in the workplace. Maybe in the near future, if you do spill coffee over yourself or something similar, or on the kitchen floor, whatever you want to call it, you could end up using some sort of epsilite-based compound to help clean it up. And it's quite nice to think that someone else's workplace mishap could contribute to you alleviating the damage caused by yours. This is Dean Burnett for the Pod Delusion. This, a much shorter version of this rant appeared in the G2 magazine on Thursday. That's the Guardian's magazine. And you can read my blog online, Brain Flapping, on the Guardian website. I can never remember the full URL address. Just look it up. It's fine. And hopefully speak to you again. Goodbye.
Now, I know what you're thinking. You're too happy. So, in this next report, Dawn Firth Godby here has been looking at why FGM has been in the news recently. If you don't know what FGM stands for, then prepare to be depressed. Here's Dawn.
Concerns about FGM, or female genital mutilation, have been getting a lot of press recently, and for good reason. Female genital mutilation is the partial or whole removal of a girl's external genitals in order to reduce sexual desire. Blades, razors and scissors are often used by non-professionals and it is carried out without anaesthetic. A small hole is left for urine and menstrual blood to flow and the hole is cut later to allow for sexual intercourse and it has to be cut again for childbirth. This can have long-term health implications. It is a practice which takes place mainly in African and Middle Eastern countries, and the reasons given as to why it's performed are social and cultural. There are no health benefits, and girls and women who have gone through this process can suffer various physical and psychological trauma throughout their lives, and it's particularly dangerous for women and children in childbirth. It's difficult to know just how many girls and women are suffering because of the taboo surrounding FGM. But an estimated 30 million girls are thought to be at risk in the next decade, and it's estimated that 125 million women and girls that are alive today have suffered this, according to UNICEF. The age at which girls are cut depends on the cultural context and can be in infancy right up to the late teens, but generally they tend to be young girls, as the ORCID project points out. This contravenes human, women's and children's rights. The main problem in tackling an issue like this is due to the social, cultural and religious sensitivity. However, a number of groups have recognised that this issue cannot be ignored because of this. Female genital mutilation is also known as female circumcision and female genital cutting, which is the preferred or the politically correct terminology according to the ORCID project, a charity who are attempting to bring an end to the female genital cutting, and TOSTAN, a US non-governmental organisation who are attempting to educate and empower African communities, helping them to achieve positive social transformation. Gannon Gillespie, TOSTAN's Director of External Relations, when asked about why female genital cutting is the preferred term for the practice, explains that circumcision implies parallels with male circumcision and that, quote, the term cutting allows them, TOSTAN, to accomplish more than the others because it's less judgmental and value-laden, end quote. TOSTAN argue that groups are more likely to engage in talks that can end this practice. They do state that they are not using the term FGC to excuse the practice, but they do point out that social pressures within the communities means that uncut women are socially rejected and that the parents who allow this to be done to their children are acting through love because they don't want their children to be excluded from society. This suggests a softly approach, but others argue that this is child abuse and should be considered mutilation. The World Health Organization suggests, quote, it reflects a deep-rooted inequality between the sexes and constitutes an extreme form of discrimination against women. There are issues brought forward by feminists in the UK that can seem quite petty, but this is a feminist cause that should be taken very seriously. Unfortunately, there are cultures and religions that still discriminate against women and mutilate children for what is claimed to be good reason, and we are urged not to question them because people have a right to their culture or religion. Some people say that we shouldn't judge another culture or religion by our own Western Eurocentric standards. But when it comes to, as the World Health Organization put it, violation of a person's rights to health, security and physical integrity, the right to be free from torture and cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment, and the right to life where the procedure results in death, end quote. This practice should not be tolerated for any reason. Though the health risks that occur through FGM are demonstrably more serious than male circumcision, this is also something that disregards the child's human rights. Therefore, this should also be the choice of the individual when they become an adult and not a practice that should be carried out on a child. In the press recently, there have been reports of young girls being sent away to their countries of birth or the parents' country of birth to be cut. One report told of a woman who had sent her child away against her father's wishes, who didn't approve of the practice. This seems to perhaps support studies that are showing that there is a growing intolerance for the practice, particularly amongst men. There are substantially more men than women in Chad, Guinea and Sierra Leone that want to see it stopped. Tradition seems to be a major factor, as with many issues, and it appears that the older generations are more likely to be for the practice than the younger generations. Though there are many groups and charities trying to put an end to this, it seems that the main problem is in the cultural and religious sensitivity of the issue. But when a child or a woman or anybody else's welfare is involved, you have to ask why this should even be an issue, no matter what the culture or religion. The point I'm trying to make is that you cannot claim that something isn't bad and it shouldn't be tolerated because it is part of a culture or a religion. I'm not attacking cultures or any specific cultures here. What I'm saying is that if something is intrinsically wrong, we should work together to remove that factor from our cultures for the sake of everyone. I'm also trying to point out that what is good or bad for one should be considered good or bad for the other. FGM and male circumcision, they're very different, consist of mutilation of an individual's and usually a child's genitals, neither of which should be tolerated. Last year, a German court ruled that circumcision amounts to bodily harm in a case that involved a doctor who performed a circumcision on a boy, which led to medical complications. The ruling outraged Jewish and Muslim groups, and according to BBC News, the president of Germany's Central Council of Jews, Dieter Graumann, said it was an unprecedented and dramatic intervention in the right of religious communities to self-determination. But the court's judgment said the fundamental right of the child to bodily integrity outweighed the fundamental rights of the parents. The FGM Special Initiative, a programme run over 3 years to protect those at risk, are finding that community work is helping in changing the attitudes within these communities and that religious beliefs on the matter can be overcome, but they suggest that it requires the government to support it by prosecuting offenders. So far in the UK, no prosecutions have been made. More work needs to be done in working with the communities to help them to realise this is wrong without them feeling that their religion or culture is being attacked. But we have to be careful treading on eggshells where people's health and well-being is concerned. The rights of a human being have to come before an ideology. This is Dawn Firth Godby here for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, Chris Chapman has been thinking about the portrayal of mental health in the media, and has been wondering if the best medium for this isn't films, but video games. Here's Chris explaining more.
This year has already seen headlines full about the use of antidepressants. We're now using them at record levels, at more than 50 million prescriptions a year, warned grave voices, asking questions such as, are doctors over-medicalising? Almost universally, the rise was portrayed as a bad thing, which ignored many of the positive factors contributing to it, such as more people getting treatment. But for me, the media coverage hammered home a different point. It's the fact that mental health is still one of the great taboos. There is still stigma that needs to be addressed. The World Health Organization predicts that by 2020, depression will be the second leading cause of disability throughout the world. One in four people in the UK every year suffers a mental health problem. We need to get over this taboo pretty quickly, and that means reaching into the public consciousness. And of course, that means mainstream culture. To an extent, mental health problems are already being addressed here. This year, Silver Linings Playbook, which addressed bipolar disorder, saw Jennifer Lawrence claim an Oscar. But film isn't the best medium. Sure, it can present issues in an emotive way, but increasingly, entertainment is becoming personalised and immersive. If you look at the big trends in culture, one medium stands out in its ability to transport you directly into another perspective. Video games. So, how are games addressing mental health? In the past, not very well. Generally, mental health problems in games used to either be used to create a scare or for humour. Let's start with humour. Sidekicks are often shown to have mental health problems and were encouraged to have a giggle at them. This is inherent in some of the evil characters as well. Take, for example, the 1998 classic Baldur's Gate. Your second possible companion is the mad wizard Tsar. If you're in doubt he's crazy, just Google for his portrait. Now, I also said scary. Perhaps it's best illustrated by my favourite creepy computer level of all time, Thief Deadly Shadows Robbing the Cradle. In it, you have to creep through an insane asylum. It's chilling, it's frightening, and it traps into a very primordial fear. Asylums were also used in games like Hitman and classics such as the year 2000 hit American McGee's Alice. In the game, Alice, of Wonderland fame, has gone insane. She's locked up in an asylum and has to work her way through a corrupted version of Wonderland, corrupted in her own consciousness. Now, this makes sense. Video games are a visual medium, after all. It's where their power lies. But the problem is that even though a protagonist is being portrayed as having a mental health condition, the madness is never defined. Is Alice bipolar, schizophrenic, depressed? I challenge you to find out. And so the gamer has no context as to what they're seeing. It's a catch-all grab bag of psychoses to further the plot. A similar, though different, problem occurs in the 2006 hit The Elder Scrolls Oblivion. For those of you too young, that's the one before Skyrim. In it, the mad god Sheogorath sends the protagonist into his realm. It's deliberately, beautifully bipolar. Half the world is bright and vivid, half the world is ashen grey and depressing. It's meant to clearly show the two different sides of mania and depression. Manic depression, or bipolar disorder as it's now called. And it's meant to do it in an interesting and visual way. But the game doesn't use this landscape at all. Depressed people sit around being depressed. Manic people have quirky ideas. At no point do you ever get the feeling you can help them. In fact, you're told they are beyond help. At one point, you're encouraged to assist someone's suicide. That is a disastrous concept to portray to gamers. Help is the key element that's missing in video game portrayals. In fact, I'll illustrate this with two famous protagonists who have clear mental health problems. Max Payne, who is recovering from the trauma of his wife and child being murdered, and Commander Shepard in Mass Effect, who witnesses a child being blown out of the sky early in Mass Effect 3. Apologies for spoilers there, it's a very pivotal moment in the start of the game though. There are three reasons I've singled these characters out. The first is that their latest incarnations were released only in 2012, and shows how video games are moving towards creating stories involving characters with mental health conditions, but not going far enough. This first positive trait follows a second, more harmful one. The characters have backstories explaining their mental health condition. While traumatic events do trigger mental health problems in some patients, presenting this as the sole reason is very dangerous. You don't have a specific event that gives you depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, any more than a single event gives you diabetes, high blood pressure, or glaucoma. Yet video games insist there has to be an explained reason. But worse than this is reason three. Neither of these protagonists seek help in the game. Max drowns his torment in pills and alcohol, which, grant you, suits his hardball genre, but doesn't really give an encouraging message. Shepard, on the other hand, lives with his or her trauma to the point that, well, I won't spoil it, but the ending is stupid. And Shepard even has a doctor on board who's a close confidant. But you may argue that getting help isn't fun, nor is replicating treatment regimens. You've got a point. But actually, treatment can be shown to be fun. And games don't have to be real-life simulators. One of the most famously dull games ever is Desert Bus, designed by Penn and Teller, which accurately represents driving a bus for 8 hours along a deserted road. It's deliberately meant to show that games don't have to be real-life. And treatment medications are represented in games at some times. Far Cry 2, for example, has you taking pills for malaria. But the best game that's haven't shown people getting help for mental health conditions is actually a strange one, The Sims Medieval. Here, if a whale ate your parents, and again, spot the shoehorn backstory, it realistically gives you all the symptoms of depression. Your mood is soured, you're lethargic and disinterested. You try and do something, but you don't have the will or the energy, you can't muster it up. And the sim can get help. Granted, I'd rather they could go to the physician character and get treatment, never a cure for their depression. But I'll take go whale hunting as a proactive step. Now, that's a brief potted history of mental health in video games. What exactly do I think needs to change? Well, for starters, I want to see characters with relatable problems take action and show it's okay to do so. I want to see games participate in societal change. I want them to acknowledge mental health problems and show people that they can be treated. In the same way that some games, not enough, but some, have begun to show it's okay for a hero to be gay, or a woman, or, shock horror, a gay or bisexual woman. I'll leave you with this thought. Call of Duty, Medal of Honor, anything with Tom Clancy's name on it, all have military advisors to get the details right. Some even liaise with gun manufacturers to get the feel of a weapon in a game correct. Now, in the UK, very few people are going to know what an MP5 should feel like. But developers repeatedly insist accuracy is vital. Brothers in Arms, a game that itself features combat stress, hires people to recreate Second World War unit tactics. But I don't know of any game where a psychiatrist has been consulted on the portrayal of mental health, so that it engages with people, encourages them to seek help, and brings this option to our entire community. This has been Chris Chapman, going through his old games collection for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to 200 episodes of podcast archives, as well as loads more on the Pod Delusion extra feed. I'm pretty impressed we've made it to 200 shows. Let's hope we keep going. So thanks for listening for all this time. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, or even find out how to get involved in the show yourself. And whilst there, please do subscribe or donate £5 or £10 a month. Or, you know, perhaps employ me? All the donations help us pay the server bills and those sorts of things. And if you employ me, you could help me buy food and pay rent and that sort of thing. So you can find my CV and the links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Tessa Kendall, Rich Firth-Godbehere, Dawn Firth-Godbehere, yes, those two are married, it's not just a coincidence, Keir Liddle, Dean Burnett, Chris Chapman, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch in a Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
So that's the plan. You distract the mark, and I'll come in from the rear to grab the goods. We'll be away before she even knows it's gone.
Oh, I don't know, Barney. Something smells really fishy to me.
Tom, it's all fishy. This pays off, we'll have a pound of salmon to share between us. We'll be fat cats.
Yeah, but why is it me on distraction? You'll be in and out, and I'll lose a couple of handfuls of fur to a dizzy biddy with a stroking fixation.
So what's a few clumps? You're a Persian. You're all fur.
I know what this is. Now the UK started that cat DNA database to help solve crimes, you want to make sure I'm in the frame while you slink away.
But how would they Look, that database is to catch humans that have been around cats. No one's searching for purring, piskeen pilferers.
They arrest cat burglars.
But cat burglars aren't actual cats.
Look, Barney, when the milk turns sour, I ain't gonna be the pussy to drink it. You run the distraction, I'll grab the salmon.
Tom, you can do the big-eyed cute thing. I'm an alley cat, gone astray. I'm no smitten kitten. I can't distract an old woman while you swoop and swipe. What's going to you?
Look, I ain't no scaredy cat. I'm just wondering why there are so few cats around lately.
Forget about it. You know what curiosity does to us. This is our chance to score, and score big. We'll really land on our feet with this one.
We're cats, Barney. We always land on our feet. And if that DNA database doesn't point the long paw of the law at us, then where's the mafioso moggy who runs the fish rackets round here?
The Codfather. Yeah, he got caught. But not through the DNA database. He just chose the wrong time to take a cat nap. They literally caught him sleeping with the fishes.
So, what happened to him?
He's got previous. They gave him 9 life sentences.
Oh, this is all too hot for me. With that database out there, we criminal cats aren't safe anymore. I'm going to change my identity. I'm going to hide out as a Labrador.
Now, you don't know what you're missing out on, Tom. And you won't escape detection that way anyhow.
Why not?
You never heard of lab reports?